Welcome, everybody, to episode number 10 of Circuit Breaker Podcast. The setup is a little bit off today, off the rails, so to speak. I have not hacked my mic stand as well as my guest today. And I have a very special guest for episode 10. I did a very, very old friend of mine who we've been part of the startup scene, and then we both joined the innovation scene roughly about the same time and have been doing hardware, video, all sorts of cool stuff together for a very long time. So, Christian, you work for an innovation department, one of like 900 million for a very large company. We cannot say. But yeah, so what do you do? Who are you? And what keeps you kind of interesting?
So good morning. Thanks for having me on. My role is I work for a Fortune 100 in an innovation lab. We do technology research, we develop proof of concepts, and we sort of serve as a consulting arm inside the company for new innovation, new technology, integration of those technologies into the business. I've been in that space for about 6 years. I know we kind of had divergent paths and you know, we both sort of went in innovation at the same time. So definitely has been an interesting journey, moving from, you know, sort of basic systems engineering type work I used to do to innovation and getting to know that space. So,
you know, it's funny as like right before we started the podcast, and it's funny as I've learned my lesson, and now I'm learning from other podcasters is why you hit record later. But I'm also somewhat, I'd say lazy. I like to do live to tape very much. I'll cut through stuff, but the conversation we had right before this, it was absolutely brilliant in the sense of you sat down and talked about, you know, where is innovation going for the enterprise space, right? So enterprise, really, you had the like one of the sharpest statements I've heard yet, because we keep on hearing about innovation. You know, you pointed out very much so that 6 years ago you talked about IoT is the next big thing.
Yeah, IoT.
And IoT has now come and gone, and we realize it's a data play. And big data, like right before IoT, was the next big thing.
Exactly.
And now we're at the point of convergence. So, I mean, you know, you're looking at it from an enterprise perspective and saying, you know, it's not just I'm putting a beacon for this business unit to act better, but what's the platform?
Yeah, and so, you know, I think that's really big right now. It's really, everybody's been talking about these different pieces, and there's this acronym called SMACs in innovation, which is like social, mobile, analytics, cloud, and sensors, right? So SMACs is sort of this, you know, you can see, read it online. It's this very generic phrase for the kinds of technology that we're innovating around. And in the past, like most things, enterprise has been a little bit behind in terms of innovation. No enterprise is really barreling over. They're not bleeding edge. So when you have all these technologies, a lot of times people are bringing them in piecemeal. They're just trying to explore. Oh, this team would like to touch beacons, or this team would like to know, understand drones, like from agricultural drones. You know, we've done sensors for like soil samples and things like that. So there's all these different sort of one-off experiments that people do when they're introducing an enterprise to these innovative technologies. But I think that as we start to mature, what you see is enterprise is really not interested in making these small investments in like one-off solutions. What they really want to understand is how they build an IoT platform that is accessible to everybody. You know, so look at it like IoT gateways and things like that. You know, HP, people like that make these IoT gateways, and they're really looking like, well, how do we take this and scale this up to an enterprise level?
You know, you're absolutely correct, and I think it's really interesting. Is you know, it's not only the fact that I think what happened was everybody started dipping their toe in the water and then saying, okay, yeah, we'll make all these little small bets, see where we see really good results, and then kind of grow from there. And with those results and growth and everything else, people finally realized, oh, hey, actually, you know, that's not what it is. What it is the growth is actually in the services that tie all these little small bets together. Right. And so I think that's what's been going on. And, you know, as we grow to enterprise to consumer, there's like the kind of circular tie-in as well. So it's kind of funny to watch two sides of it. One is the data play, right? So now enterprise is leveraging data much better for not only their operations, but their operations and then their interactions with the consumers as well.
Yeah, and I think, I think if we move back to IoT or we moved any of these, ultimately many of these innovations are data plays. IoT is about collecting massive amounts of data. But on the back end, there has to be a way of sifting through it and connecting it to some sort of analytics or intelligence to kind of give you some insights. And I think that from our standpoint, I think that's where enterprise has been slow, because enterprise has generally relied on these big data warehouses like Teradata and things like that. And a lot of times their data can be siloed between different divisions. It can be siloed different business units. And I think that we're only now getting to the point where people are starting to look at, well, how do we build data lakes? How do we create integrated platforms with APIs so that people can access this, so we can rapidly develop mobile-first architecture? And so I think that that's where enterprise has sort of struggled in really getting innovation, these innovative technologies, to take off, is they really haven't had a way to interface with this massive amount of data.
Well, not only interface, but actually make use of the data. It was really funny. I was talking the other day to another friend, and they delivered a bunch of great insights, actually physically parsed through all this data and really delivered them some great, great things. And that was actually from another Fortune, actually 10 company. And it was two big, very well-known Fortune 10 companies that worked with each other on this data stuff. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, and they can't even make use of this data. They're like, look, we gave you all these insights. They're like, yeah, these are great insights. These actually tell us what's going on, but we have no actionable way to take care of them. So I think also that's another huge part of it, is even though IoT is enabling us and data is enabling us and we have the better answer for all this stuff, what we don't have is the ability to do something with that sensor data we collected and all the IoT processes we did. Actually, I think that's where more of our innovation from a day-to-day perspective is.
And I think, you know, you've heard that term, or, you know, I've heard the term used before, that big companies tend to be data rich, but information poor.
I haven't heard that in a long time, but you're absolutely correct.
They have reams and reams of data. They have more data than they know what to do with, literally more data than they know what to do with. And what they haven't really had the opportunity to do or really done is invest in those platforms. You know, we talk in innovation, we talk a lot about machine learning, deep learning, predictive analytics, these sort of big, you know, analytics plays. And they really haven't had an opportunity to invest in these platforms that tie all of this massive data storage, both past, present, what's being generated, to some insights engines that allow them to really extract value from that data. You know, you have people at big companies, and it's not our company, it's every company, and they're essentially doing their analytics in Excel. They dump huge amounts of data into Excel, they build charts, they come out with it, and you know, that we may have some, companies may have some algorithms in a system, but they're older, they don't really take advantage of rapid learning, cross-platform data. It's usually they're analyzing one data source.
And the no structure versus structured data.
Correct.
All of those things. You know, the funniest thing, when you say Excel, the most nightmarish one that I know of, and you're absolutely correct, everybody's still in Excel, and I'm like, oh my God, the spreadsheet tools from like the 80s. But the one that surprises me the most is the state of Texas releases all of the school information for every single mm-hmm. school and every single school district and everything else in a one row, 9 million column. It's not exactly 9 million, but it's ridiculous hundreds of thousands of column spreadsheet. It's mm-hmm. one row. And so anytime an Excel, like any sort of Excel program or a Windows Excel or Mac Excel, whatever it is, whenever Excel tries to open it, it crashes. It can't handle the data. And how they output it to an Excel file is beyond me, how they managed to put that together. But so basically you have to go get something that will parse this Excel file, recategorize it, and then then dump it into something that's
somebody
actually
wrote
usable.
A Python or PowerShell script somewhere just dumps it all the data in there.
Yeah, exactly. And then I have a good buddy of mine who managed to undo it. He was like, "Oh my god, I had to go back and learn .NET just because it was something that was the easiest to work with the stupid thing."
Oh yeah, yeah.
But he's done some amazing stuff with his data and then tied it to sensor data for a city. And so now you can see like live Dart bus views and live Dart bus views or public transit views or whatever it is, and Dart being the local one for Dallas here. But he's got all those pieces, and then he's also got the crime stats and all this other stuff for the local city. And it's cool. You can see like how does the crime stats affect the school, and how does public transportation affect the school, and how does this affect the school and real estate value and everything else. And so you have all this fascinating data that not only a realtor could use, but also all these other folks are using, and the city is now jumping on board, and there's a lot of innovation behind it. So it's fascinating that these are all sensor plays. If you look at it, it's like the Dart bus has a sensor on it to tell you where it is, and it has GPS monitoring. The real estate prices are pretty standard data. School grades are pretty standard data. But people are now starting to finally understand how to grasp this information and really make use of it.
And I think, you know, there's a more, I think part of it is companies aren't looking to have the architecture capability in-house. And now there's a lot of external tools for helping them. So, for instance, you have something like a Salesforce. Not to call out any particular company, but something like Salesforce, and they have their Einstein platform, right? And Einstein is made to analyze the sort of data that Salesforce stores, that very specific data that Salesforce stores. But now Einstein has Watson integration, and Watson's strength is really in that unstructured data that you were talking about. Like, how do we pull in that external unstructured data, sentiment analysis, or, you know, like demographic data or whatever from external sources. So I think that as these external platforms have matured, companies have started to say, okay, now without having to build a deep understanding of these technologies in-house, we can still have these capabilities. So I think there's been sort of a wait and see, let's see what the market builds, where enterprise is concerned. Whereas I think a lot of more forward-thinking companies or smaller companies that had a little more agility, we're interested in how do we build our own platform? How do we use this to get competitive advantage? You know, and I think that's incredibly important for companies.
You know, and the other thing is, it's kind of dangerous. I think it's a double-edged sword. You're right. You're absolutely right. How do we build our own platform to get that much more ahead of the competition? But there's something to be said. I mean, there's a standardization in Excel, unfortunately. And there's a standardization in a couple of tools. Now, there are competitive tools. There's the really, really super archaic Lotus Suite, which, for whatever reason, certain large companies still use.
Yeah.
I don't know how and how much patching and duct taping is involved.
Yeah.
we can go on to that in another podcast and cover like at least another hour in that. But there's Lotus, Office, and to an extent Google for Work, or whatever you want to call it. And I notice it's Google for Work is actually now tractioning on a lot larger companies, only because as startups adopted it, they've kind of adopted it and grown up and now are too big to get out of a whole Google for Work system. And it's just a democratized system that's much nicer. So, you know, it's fascinating to me. Even though you want to get an edge, it almost becomes valuable, and to your point, not picking out a company one way or another, Salesforce is one of those companies that has become a standardized tool, just like Office has.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the things that can happen is, and we see this, I think, in companies of every size, and I'll use machine learning or deep learning as an example, but this actually happens across lots of tools. So one of the problems that you see with, say, an enterprise where they develop their own toolkit is that they tend to be a develop once and then stagnate type of environment. Very, very often you'll see companies invest significant resources to develop a capability. But the maintenance, the rest of the time, the money spent on that utility that they've developed is essentially keeping the lights on money, you know, patching, small things like that, support for ongoing. You don't really see these systems routinely updated to modern architectures. You don't really see that. And you have these external companies that once they develop this capability, like Salesforce with their machine learning and their predictive analytics, as a company, their competitive advantage is in continually upgrading that platform. So essentially, by not jumping early and developing their own capability, they're able to connect with a cloud-based system that will update for them, you know, that will constantly be, you know, as new things are discovered, as new architectures are discovered, they'll just be able to take advantage of that.
Yeah, and it's still innovation to an extent, right?
Because
the
exactly.
guys that, yeah, and actually it's very good innovation. It's pragmatic innovation, and I think that's what we're missing.
And I think we have to back up, because I think that so many times people think innovation is the technology, and innovation is what you do with the technology, right?
Yeah.
Innovation has nothing to do with, oh, we have beacons, we're innovative. Oh, we have a machine learning engine, we're innovative. If you still do nothing, if all that machine learning engine does is sit in a back room and spit out dashboards and nobody really looks at them and nobody really actually takes it seriously, then it's still not innovation. It's you know.
It's noise.
Exactly. And I think that that's what that's a risk. And I think that because I think that when you have companies who do that, when they invest money in these, then people don't – they stop – valuing innovation as much. They start to see innovation as just generating sort of worthless projects, like, oh, that's really nice, but, right? And
right.
You, every time you hear that but, there's someone wondering how they justify your budget next year, right? So I think that that's a big thing. And so understanding, I think that, you know, for us, our big challenge is always, you know, to go into it, is to kind of drop back into that design thinking mentality. And say, like, don't start at a technology, start at a problem, right? Okay. Start at a, what do we want the world to look like when we've implemented this? And then work backward from there. Because I think really you have to have a vision of what you want to accomplish. You have to have a vision of how this adds business value. And then work backwards. And sometimes it means you don't use cool new technology you'd love to use. Sometimes you stick with tried and true familiar stuff. But sometimes you do get to say, like, hey, if you want the world to look like this, here's some what you need to adopt, and this is new and it's radical. And sometimes companies jump on that, and then, you know, that shows them, oh, this is some value that innovation provides.
Well, it's not even that. You're absolutely correct, but it's more like Legos. Like, we grew up
yeah.
with Legos and we still play with them, but it's the same brick that we've played with since we were kids.
Oh yeah.
The designs are totally different now, like, right? So
absolutely.
It's using the off-the-shelf parts, but in a new and different way. And sometimes a business process that didn't exist, couldn't have existed. And to an extent, technology does help, because we're now able to do things rapidly, save time in certain areas, and various other things, like, right? So email changed the world in the sense mm-hmm. of the way we communicate. So hell, even telephones did. And now it's... Okay, well, we got bored of email. Let's go to Slack. And we got bored of Slack because I have, like, way too many Slack channels. What's the next big thing, right? And so it's one of those things where utilizing the off-the-shelf tools, but what does that enable you to do, and how does that enable you to communicate in a totally different way? Speaking of communication, your house talks to you, or, like, not even your house yet, right? This is the funny part is, so last week we had Yesh on. And he's telling me that, you know, related to all this IoT stuff and everything else, and he's a voice and speech expert. That's one of his big things. That and machine learning are two of his big things. And he's been working on a lot of Alexa and Google integration and things like that. And so, you know, as we're getting up this morning, because I come to Nerdvana every Saturday morning to record this podcast, and then try to release it out Sunday night or so. And my phone tells me, hey, dum-dum, it's ready to go. And the tollway has a lot of traffic on it, or it's closed again today. You should probably leave in 30 minutes instead of 20 minutes that it normally takes to get you there. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you even see this on your weekday commute and then on Friday nights, right? I mean, you have your normal thing on Friday nights. And
oh, yeah. And I think that that's, you know, if you look back to sort of the original, when IoT was burgeoning, when this sort of machine learning intelligence was capabilities were first being talked about, smart houses were one of those things that people were trying to use to sell that capability, right? Your house, your toaster would know, your coffee maker would know, your car would know when to start and start warming itself up. Like, all of these things would happen because your house would, not just your house, but everything would be talking to everything else.
It was like a cross between the Jetsons house and the Starship Enterprise, right?
Exactly. Like, everything sort of knew what your next move was and kind of started to learn to adjust with your schedule. And I think that's, you know, here we are. You know, even that was sort of a promise before, even you and I got an innovation. So, you know, 10 years on and we're we have Google Home. I can tell it to turn my lights on and off, but it still doesn't know when to turn my lights on and off. It still doesn't understand my patterns of behavior. And I think that's where we're still, where we still have that gap is that, there's just not a general intelligence in the things around us. And I think IoT, I don't say suffers from it, but I think that's a big hurdle in terms of where these systems are going. Now, on the other hand, I really think that, you know, I remember the first time that my phone told me to get on the road. My reaction at first was kind of like, oh, that's cool. And then my second reaction was, and that's kind of creepy.
Everybody's reaction's been that.
But I think that, you know, generationally, I think that younger people sort of, this is normal for them. And I think that again, it becomes sort of a generational thing. I think there's resistance from people who are currently home buyers to the idea that their home knows so much about them.
It's funny how did we become the old gray hairs, like with the cane saying, get off my lawn?
I know, it's...
And we're two of the early adopter
Speak
crowd.
Speak for yourself. It's true. We are early adopters, but I think that, you know, like I would welcome a smart home, but I realize that, you know, for every me, there's 10 people who are like, I just don't need my house to know that much information about me. You know, I don't need my house, you know, and look, there's some founded fear because technically speaking, anything my house knows, it's always potential that someone else knows, right?
And yeah, there's a lot of security. I mean, every episode brings up a security top bit of it, and no one's figured it out. But I think, you know, where we are is still, it's dangerous, right? Because there's been like instances of neighbors opening each other's houses with Siri or Alexa, or pick your favorite voice assistant. Mm-hmm. Some are more portable, some are not.
Well, now we can pay Amazon to open our houses for us, right?
That's right. It's even now, more goofball.
Now we can pay Amazon to let our delivery people open up our houses
and chuck stuff inside the house and potentially crack the vase in the front.
Exactly.
Front door or whatever. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's that, but it was brought up last week that the assistants are still kind of like toys. They're adult version of toys. They're you know, we had the little poll thing that said, what does the cow say? Moo. And it's almost like Alexa is that right now. It's Alexa, I can't ask you very many questions. And or it's I can't answer that.
Well, and I think that's what, yeah, I actually had this discussion last night with my wife. We were, you know, saying that it's weird because the more you have these assistants in your home, the more you start to talk to them like you expect them to actually understand what you're saying. You know, like I think that as things get slightly better, it actually fools us even more. You know, when you can say like, hey, who won the game last night? Or hey, what's the weather going to be tomorrow? And it answers you. But then you try to tell, to give a real example, it to play a song in all your rooms because you have multiple of these things. And then it somehow integrates in all your rooms into the song title and it doesn't, you know, you have to say it, you have to like break up like play, pause, this song, pause, in all the rooms. Like you start to have to change your cadence. And that's something you don't expect. Like it starts to introduce these points of frustration. And I think that as you are interfacing with this technology, that's going to be a continual, like, again, it relegates that piece of technology to the level of being kind of a toy. You're not going to count on it for anything important. And I think that as you rig up the smart home, that's the whole point, is like, can I count on this to do important things that I need it to do? And if the answer is no, then certainly it's not worth $20,000 extra to have everything wired and smart and have sensors everywhere and whatever. So I think that's kind of, you know, to kind of bring it back full circle, I think that ends up being the same challenge that enterprise has, except yeah. scaled up, right? How is this platform worth $20 million if it basically is a toy? It doesn't really solve a real problem that we couldn't solve manually in the same time, right?
And is it making or adding any efficiencies for us? And yeah. at this moment, I mean, there are a lot of things that are adding efficiencies, and then there mm-hmm. are a lot of things that are not adding those efficiencies, and I think we're getting there. So totally kind of going around this same home topic, what's the cool stuff that you personally, I mean, because everybody that comes on, you know, I know has some sort of cool project. We all are not just at work, and we are all smarter than that. Mm-hmm. I know you're just as much of a nerd and play with all sorts of cool stuff. What's the cool, fun project you're working on at home right now?
Well, I think beyond sort of wiring my house up, you know, I've been doing more in terms of, putting these toys in my home, just because I really want to get, you know, I need to get ahead of my company. My company has consumers and customers. They use the technology. So it makes sense for me to use it on a daily basis, understand how it benefits consumers, and then that helps inform me on projects we can do to bring ourselves in line with those consumer benefits. But beyond that, you know, I've really been getting into video lately. I don't know why. I used to film video a lot. But then I stopped. You know, I've got kids. They were younger. My kids are older now. They're graduating from high school. And now I find myself with more free time. And I'm like, wow, I just need to get out and start doing this. So for me, my spare time has really been in getting back and understanding that the tools that build that.
You know, and actually, that's a huge thing, right? Even that is becoming something that is actually absolutely important. A lot of the world's largest technology companies mm-hmm. are now really, really, truly kind of going that direction. It was really funny I can't believe it was so long ago, but kind of over 10 years ago, I remember hearing, hey, we need to figure out how we're building all these cooler, faster, more amazing networks. What's the biggest thing you're going to shove down the pipe for it? And honestly, still today, even nothing really utilizes bandwidth more than video, and even then real time video.
Well, and I think if you look at a corporate intranet, right? In most companies, most corporate intranets today are tons of words. They're just lots of pages of information, right? And I think what you're finding is that more and more, especially as you're starting to you know, have this generation graduate college, they're starting to come in, your new hires, sort of your new company blood, these people are used to consuming their media in different forms, you know, in either interactively through applications or through video platforms, things like that. So, you know, kind of what got me into doing personal video is that for the last year or so, I've been in charge sort of as a side job at work for recording video, corporate video for the company, and editing and doing all that. And so we started to really target not just younger people and have these video available, but we've also been able to target, for instance, different foreign languages, things like that. And I think it makes it very personal. You know, if I record one of our senior executives and they are speaking in Spanish and we release that And the Latin American markets, they love it. They go absolutely crazy because they're like, wow, this is really, this is for us. You know, this is, you know, this is something that, like, how often are they catering this information to us? Same thing, you know, when we did one in Mandarin, it's very much like, hey, we have these huge employee bases who speak these foreign languages, and everything is English, right? But like, how do we target these markets directly and say, hey, we value you as people. We value you, you know, your language, your culture. So we're going to talk about things that are relevant to you in the language that is relevant to you.
And that's a huge piece of it, right? Now we're breaking barriers. I mean, that's another huge piece of the video piece is
there's two things we say on the audio podcast.
Yeah, exactly. We say this on the audio podcast, but, you know, it's kind of funny to me is I do this because it's the easiest way to do this, and I don't have to spend as much time editing. But one of those things, and I can also dress really scrubby because right after this, like I said, I run around on Saturdays. But one of those things that's really fascinating to me is it's taking less and less effort to do the video too, right? Right before we started recording, we were talking about the history of all the various different editing tools and things like that. But now, even more so, there's like little cameras. Like, I guess it's called Mevo or MEVO or something, whatever it is. But Livestream was recently bought, by the way, by Vimeo, which I didn't know this until a good friend of mine told me. They're a good friend of ours, actually. You remember Philip Nelson?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Philip was telling me that Livestream just bought Vimeo. I'm like, what? What's going on? Which makes sense. I mean, they're getting into the live stream game. But video tools are more and more pervasive out there. And then Mevo's little device, it's phenomenal. It lets you control, like, quote unquote, three cameras, even though it's just angling the way it does things via a mobile phone. And so now I'm able to take one camera instead of three, set it up really quickly, and it's the size of my coffee cup, and it kind of goes. And that's crazy to me.
Well, I think that you're starting to see, you know, you look at the rise. If you look at YouTube, right, which, you know, unarguably the largest video platform on the planet, the biggest people on that are people who are just, you know, vloggers, right? You know, or do their like vlog type style shows.
Yeah, it's very webcam-y.
Casey Neistat, Philip DeFranco. You know, these folks who do this, this video, and they reach millions of people. You know, I think Casey Neistat has like 8.9 million followers.
Yeah.
Philip DeFranco has like 5.7. I mean, even people like Marques Brownlee, who does the technology reviews, he has 5.7 million. And so you have these enormous populations following these individuals, these personalities. And I think that becomes a big thing is that people start to become brands, right?
Yeah.
And I think that what that also means, though, is that regular people are looking for a more personal touch from their brands. You know, they respond to that personal part of the Philip DeFranco brand, the Casey Neistat brand. They're responding to the person. And I think that, you know, conversely, when you especially look at younger people, they want a more personal brand. They want someone they feel is talking to them, someone they feel represents them. And I think that that's, you know, shows that sort of shift in the way people are perceiving video. And I think that that's what we try to, you know, video starts to become more important, not just for, you know, commercials or marketing or whatever, but also the way you interact with your own employees, the way you interact with your coworkers, the way you share knowledge and information. And it's just a much better way, you know, in the past when we would share knowledge inside the company, there'd be a manual or a document or a binder, or, you know, that binder digitized on an indexed web page out there. And now we can do screens. We can very easily do a combination of screen capture and video to train people on how these work. And if you actually look at the rise of companies like Skillshare or Udemy, or even like the Lynda library that LinkedIn bought, the growth of video training online,
it's huge,
is phenomenal. And so, you know, I use it all the time. I have a LinkedIn premium subscription. I'm on anytime somebody poke something new my way and is like, here's a new technology you got to learn, you know, an innovation. It's constant, right? Someone says, hey, you got to learn Python this week, or you got to learn, you know, R or whatever. Hop onto Lynda and somebody's got a course in it. So follow along tutorials that I can actually see on the screen. It's amazing.
No, you're absolutely correct. There's so many things out there that are changing our world. So that being said, since you're learning all sorts of video and everything else, you know, what's your favorite thing right now? What are you learning from the video perspective? Since you know, sort of, we're always learning, one. And even though we've been doing it for so long, you've just recently kind of re-picked it back up.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's your favorite new tools, set of tools? You're looking for a new gimbal for your handhelds. I mean, that's the other thing. That's the biggest thing to me is,
well, I mean,
mobile video has changed so much.
You know, I was actually going to say, I think that what you're really finding is that the tools have been commoditized, right?
Yeah.
If I look at something like 4K, right? A few years ago, 4K video was just, you know, high-end cinematographers, high-end cameras. Now it's in every iPhone. Now it's in Google Pixel. Now it's in everything. And even if you go beyond that with, like, swappable lens cameras or better cameras, you have something like the Sony RX3 version 5 or RX100 V5. This does 5K. It's a built-in. I have a Panasonic G7. So this is Micro Four Thirds swappable lens. Absolutely stunning 4K. You have the GH4, GH5. I mean, all these cameras are under $2,000. They are absolutely accessible to nearly anyone, and they shoot the same quality video that a few years ago would have only been in a cinema camera.
Your lenses, like, you have lenses on your mobile device, and it's shooting just as good quality as all the cameras you just mentioned. So even if you just pull out your mobile phone.
Yeah, I have my mobile phone, and it's got a case on it from a company called Moment.
Yeah.
And they make these amazing, like, screw-in lenses for their case that are absolutely beautiful. And you can go to Instagram, you can go to YouTube, you can actually see the work that people do with these lenses. Mine's a wide angle because I like to get a little bit of a wider shot when I'm outside filming. But the stuff you can do is absolutely incredible with slow motion and all these other things. And not only that, but, you know, you talked about, like, yeah, I'm looking to pick up a gimbal. But the gimbals I'm looking at, they're in the, you know, $500 to $800 range. I mean, they're doing the kind of work that Steadicams that cost thousands of dollars to use, and then also extensive training to operate. And with it, you know, with a few minutes of balancing, the gimbal replaces a significant amount of that and provides steady video, you know, that sort of smooth cinematic look to your video.
It's
just crazy that technology has come this far and enables consumers to have access to this. And I think it's just going to grow. And that's where you're going to see, you know, we're going to continue to be, you know, yeah, podcasts are great, but I think you're going to continue to see video become that, you know, even larger online. And it's so big right now, but the fact is everybody can do 4K video. Everybody can share 4K video out there these days.
You know, you bring up the point of the gimbal, and it's really funny, is I remember I went through a week-long cat class, and I wore a full vest, and I had the 900-pound arm.
Steadicam vest, yeah.
Steadicam, full Steadicam. And then this, like, horrendous version, I still don't like them, even though people do, is a handheld Steadicam for the smaller camcorder.
Like the Glide Cam and stuff like that, yeah.
Exactly. And so I love the big ones, but the little handheld gimbals are absolutely amazing, and I see them everywhere now. Every major conference I attend, I get to go to, like, the major cons, I get to go to CES, and I get to go to, like, Mobile World Congress and all these other things. And I see, like, 1,000 of these participants just walking around grabbing video with that.
You got companies like Jiyun, you've got Moza, you've got the DJI, obviously. And DJI, I'll come back to them in a second. But and then you've got, like, Freefly that does the Movi. And they create these, you know, for every price range, for every type of situation. And you know, when I look at that, you go back to DJI, drones, right?
Yeah.
I have a DJI Phantom Pro 3.
Nice.
DJI just released something called the Mavic Air, which is essentially a fold almost in your pocket style 4K drone. And you know, I've looked through the reviews, and it has all the pro features. Amazing. I mean, it does things like follow you around. It's got intelligence. It's got collision detection,
and it's got APIs. It's got an extensible platform to develop off of as well.
So, I mean, these kind of like things that you used to see, like helicopter shots, and back when like the DJI Inspire, which is like the $6,000 drone that they sell, it used to be the only game on the block, and now, you know, for $800 you can have your own 4K aerial shots, amazing quality, etc. And so, you know, I think that these tools that used to be reserved for cinematography only, for high-end cinematography, are becoming everyday.
It's a very democratized, I feel like we're democratizing it, just like Google did for enterprise tools for shareable documents and shareable email and shareable things like that, and calendaring and things like that, just that you only had with your Exchange calendar that Microsoft had for their enterprise customers. Google did and made it available for everybody, right? Yeah. So now everybody can collaborate and everything else like that, and it's now doing the same thing. We don't need much. I mean, if you look at our podcast setup, it's everything I carry in essentially a small little knapsack. I have a little Zoom recorder, and we have two mics and a couple of cables, and that's it.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
And the flip side of that, though, is that as all of these sort of become commoditized and democratized, the expectation of what you provide as a creator becomes higher.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like if you go back and listen to old podcasts from sort of these smaller producers, it's really basic audio. It's not super great audio. It's not. And now, because, you know, the Zoom and the Yeti microphones and sort of like these options where you have great quality microphones for a relatively cheap price compared to what they, you know, you don't have to buy the $1,200 Shure microphones or the $3,000 or whatever. Now people expect when they listen to a podcast, no matter how small you are, that your podcast audio is going to be clean. It's going to be nice. It's going to be, you know, you'll take the time to, you know, go in and isolate your noise and have your audio program pull it out. And it's going to be nice, clean audio, stuff that you would have never expected 10 years ago, you know. And the same thing with video. It's like people yawn at drone shots now, right? Yeah. So I think that it starts to become like, how can you add additional value on top of these commoditized tools? And again, that kind of goes back to that, I think, that personal brand. I think that now people are selling, not, you know, people used to be able to say like, look at my cinematography, that's my selling point. And now it's hey, look at me and my story, and then the cinematography or the audio or whatever has to lend to that story. And I think that ties back to business. Is, you know, I want to keep going back to that
you
enterprise.
You tied it back for me perfectly.
But you know, people, everybody does advertisement. Everybody does, like, what is the real relationship? How does whatever we do improve the relationship between the company and the customer and consumer, right? And that is, to me, I think, what people are looking for. They're not looking for the whiz bang, you know, show off. Oh, this is a great commercial. I think people have become, in a lot of ways, desensitized to large commercials. The commercials that tend to get the best sort of bang for their buck are these very almost personal, small. You know, you look at something like take the Doritos Crash the Super Bowl, right? From a few years back. I don't think they did one this year, but if you look at those commercials, those were like generated by real people, and they were consistently rated among the highest commercials in the Super Bowl. Budweiser's commercial this year for their water ad, right? That was how they gave back. Definitely considered a highly rated commercial.
Well, I think it's really funny is on all of those, even the I think the most, on a commercial, I've had this blog post stuck in my head for 2 weeks, and I think I'm running out of time to be able to write about it, but I can throw it out on here because it's just easier and it's faster for me to, is the a couple of things. One is the most recognized commercial now, I think, is Gatorade. And if you look at every Super Bowl ever done, what happens to the coach at the end of the game? He gets a Gatorade jar dumped on him, right? Or that mm-hmm. giant cooler thing. And Gatorade has not really paid for that ad, but it's experience. Everybody connects. It's like, when is that going to happen? It's a tradition that has to happen. The winning coach gets the Gatorade. It's not even just like any water cooler. It's the Gatorade jug exactly. that gets dumped on
it's
him.
It's got to be the colored liquid on his head. And I think that, again, that becomes the thing is that product connects to the story, right?
Right.
That product connects to the story of the sport. And I think that, you know, is how big brands can learn from small brands, can learn from individual vloggers, podcasters, things like that, that it's how do you make your product part of someone's story? How do you make your story interesting to people to the point where they want to be part of it? They want to, you know, whether it be tuning in to watch a vlogger do their latest vlog, or it be I want to pick up your product off the shelf because I want to make this part of my lifestyle. You know, there are a lot of lifestyle brands. It's exactly what it is. You know, people want to have the right clothes. They want to carry the right purse. They want to wear the right lipstick. They want to have the right phone. And I think that becomes part of, like, how do you make yourself part of that person's narrative? And I think that that's where, to go back to it, that's where all this data comes into play.
Well, so hang on before you before we circle it back, because you're absolutely correct. You pointed out perfectly. Everything is getting commoditized, and now we have to go back to, you know, technology is not solving the problem. We have so much data and everything else. Mm-hmm. But I want to put in one more point before we circle it all the way back to where we started from, which is the big companies have gotten so big and so disconnected, right? And now, if you look at it, it's funny. It's where we were losing brick and mortar left, right, and center because everything was being taken over by either Amazon or some other big .com where you went and bought all your favorite gear or favorite stuff from or anything else. I mean, we're so instant gratification now. I don't want to leave my couch whenever I want to buy something. The first thing I pull up is my Amazon app and I scan whatever.
I'm a Prime subscriber. You have no idea how many things I've had ordered to deliver today.
Yeah, and the treasure truck is even worse for me because I sit there and I picked up my Nintendo, Super Nintendo Classic from it when I was sitting in a meeting at work. I totally will admit that. But, you know, there are things like that are hugely taking away from our interaction on a daily basis. And this goes back to the reason why we're here at Nerdvana, and this place is one of the prime examples of that, is because it provides us an experience. They've got board games on one side, they've got video games on the other side, but it's an experience that we come to enjoy. And now we're turning around and really getting the interpersonal connection with something niche, small, and very personally experienced and personal branded to everybody. Mm. Now I know I'm plugging Nerdvana because it graciously let me use the studio, but it's not just them. It's a lot of other places that the big brands are now understanding that they have to differentiate themselves in that manner to provide a better experience for their end customer. And that's what draws them in. It's not the low prices. It's not the obnoxious beat yourself over the head with the new whiz bang thing. It's what is that interconnected experience that you're going to give me? And, you know, all of that is now to circle back for you is the data piece. Mm-hmm. How do you derive the data to get your customer?
Well, and the thing about it is, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, the difference in generations in terms of how they perceive data privacy, right? You know, younger generations especially are telling us who they are, right? They're on Instagram every day telling us what kind of foods they like, what kind of clothes they like. They're on social media. When they like you on Facebook, you get access to certain bits about their profile, like their likes and dislikes. They're telling us, our consumers are telling us every day who they are.
Yeah.
And what companies are having to do is get better at understanding, at finding that edge where I can say, all right, I know what Christian likes. I know what products he likes. I know what of our mix he likes. How can I offer that very personal experience to him? How can I, without crossing the line of like, hey, I'm outside your window with night vision binoculars looking in your home going, you want these spicy Doritos, you know, you want these, you want the, you want some Lucky Jeans, you know, like, you, like, what are those, you know, what's that line, and how do companies sort of get to the point where they're offering consumers personal value, but at the same time, you don't want to feel like you're right at, right inside someone's home, that you don't want to feel like you're crossing that line. Because I think that the thing about it is consumers do share all this data. They just don't like to be reminded that they're sharing all this data in a way that you can conglomerate, that you can consolidate, I mean, into a profile of them. They
no,
don't want
right.
to.
You're absolutely correct. And it's funny, as you're right. It's a balance. It's a fine balance of talking to that consumer and really working with that consumer in the way that makes them feel comfortable. But it's also that kind of, there's a balance between the creepy butler in the movie and the butler that's always there right at the right time when you're like, my coffee's running low, or I just got up and I want my breakfast now, and the butler knows you're ready, versus, you know, I feel like a Scooby-Doo butler where he's like, Scooby, can I help you? And you're like, what? Where did you come from? And why are you creepily waiting in the, I feel like the walls or something.
It's that Adam Sandler movie, Mr. Deeds.
Yeah, the yeah, butler, there
like,
you
every,
go.
Like every time he turns around, the butler's just there. Yeah, you know, and I think that, honestly speaking, I this is going to sound cliche, but the real answer is I think that companies have to learn to develop or redevelop a certain amount of empathy. They have to place value on that empathy. Like, they have to, that has to be a value that they have, is, hey, we care about our customers. Because I think that that's what, I think customers get that. I think if you come to a customer and say, hey, we want to give you this because we know you love it. Like, I'm going to give you this gift because I know you as a person and I know you're really going to enjoy this. And here, just, you know, have this, right? And I think they get that sentiment versus, hey, you want to buy this E, you know, and you open up your jacket like the old Sesame Street.
Yeah.
You know? I think that there has to be, you step away from the technology piece. We love to talk about technology, but there is just a human element to what has to happen with this data. And I think that's how we balance sort of the new world of technology with providing that customer consumer experiences. You know, how do we balance that empathy piece with our consumers? It's a challenge because companies, I'll be 100% honest with you, especially the larger the company, they're not really set up. Empathy's a nice word,
well,
but
it's funny.
But
it's,
empathy doesn't go anywhere on your balance sheet or your annual report, right?
Well, not only does it not go on your balance sheet or report, but I don't know what it is. And it's funny, is you truly do lose your soul. I mean, we both. Well, you're still currently there, and I came from a Fortune, I think it's a Fortune 10. I don't know if it's between Fortune 10 and Fortune 50. I mean, they're one of the largest in the world. There's no secret where I came from, but it's funny is I literally got brainwashed a little bit, and it almost cultishly brainwashed, but you as a human, because you're such a part of such a big cog, lose that empathy, and it's odd. It's a very odd feeling. And then joining the company I'm with now, because we are so humanly centric driven and so driven in a way that we pertain to fandom and geekdom and things, that empathy is there. And I think it's because we're driving towards an experience. And honestly, that's the cool part about us being so disruptive as a company. We're becoming larger day by day, but we're not losing our touch with our roots, because that's a huge part of the culture and ingrained into how the company is derived. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, for me, I think what's been helpful is that a lot of my work is internally focused. So because I'm dealing with the actual people every day, it helps me keep that grounding. And also because one of my my passions and the thing I'm responsible for is design thinking. Design thinking's entire message is about understanding that human user experience. I think that by approaching a lot of the problems that I do internally from that lens, it's helped me to stay grounded in that in empathy. But I do agree that, you know, when you start to, it's easy when you work for a big company to get lost in scale. Where everything becomes numbers on a spreadsheet, and you start to forget about what it is like for just one single person who goes and buys your product. You know, if you're manufacturing cars, I think you start to look like, oh, this is what the number for cars were. This is how many of this model we sold, et cetera. And you forget what it's like to be, you know, that 18-year-old graduating from high school and their parents buy them their first, you know, Toyota Camry or whatever. And they're going and they're starting their brand new car for the first time. And like to have that experience and that moment. And I think that, sure, some people retain that, but I think it's really easy to lose what that feeling is like to be that close to a customer, to be that close.
Yeah, because you're so far away.
Yeah, I mean, you're behind 10 layers of spreadsheets.
On that note, I'm just looking at our time and I'm like, oh my God, we're so far down the road on this, and this has been probably one of our longest episodes. But
oh, I'm sorry about that.
No, by the way, I was gonna say it's because I think you and I have had, you know, one of the longer histories in this entire space.
Yeah, absolutely. we've seen a lot. We've seen a lot of tech come and go, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. So based on that, I think we're gonna wrap it up for our listeners.
But excellent.
Where can people find you?
They can find me via email, me at christianritchie.com. They can find me on Twitter at XIANRitchie. And so those are the two places where I'm most likely to respond.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, I will put those in the show notes.
Excellent.
And I may not put the email address because I don't want you to get spam botted. But on that note, we will let everybody kind of carry on with their day.
Well, thanks for having me.